let me in. Shiba shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba shiba. Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or, if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. Yes, I've got my science envoy here to fill your brain with knowledge in a way that it sticks. I would like to welcome Marina Lucioni. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. So before we get into it, let's talk about, when did you discover that you were really into science?
I, as a kid, loved strawberries, and was also always very fascinated by all sorts of animals. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was young keeping banana slugs and realizing, as pets in a jar, and realizing that banana slugs also love strawberries. And I think this realization that, whoa, this animal, which is so different from me, so other, also loves the same food, was this very fundamental, I guess, feeling of like wonder and connection with the natural world.
And how old were you about that time?
Maybe like 3 or 4.
Oh,
I think.
Okay. So you're like, oh, I got my pet slug. I wonder if it, were you sharing your strawberries with
yeah.
your pet slug? Okay.
and I feel like, I think of this as maybe one of the first moments, because in the end, like, science has been my way of kind of continuing to participate mm-hmm. in that wonder and that feeling of like being a part of all of it.
Okay, so we're starting at 3, where you're sharing your favorite snacks with this your pet and realizing, wow, there's a connection there. How, like, as you're going through school, do you have a fascination with science, or does that come later?
In some ways, not really. And so maybe, okay, after the slugs, maybe the next point along that story is my grandparents' koi fish pond. So on my mom's side, that family is Indonesian, and my grandparents immigrated from Indonesia in the 80s. Uh-huh. And my grandpa built this koi fish pond, which I would spend, whenever I went to visit them, I would spend time looking at these fish and watching mm-hmm. him take care of these fish. Mm-hmm. And year on year, they would have babies. And it was always amazing to me to see that the different colors of koi fish could have smaller fish that were also completely different colors and patterns. And so that was maybe intro to genetics 101, seeing like, oh there are these mixes that can happen. And if, you know, like the two parents can create fish, like baby fish that are of completely different colors to what the original two parents mm-hmm, were. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe a beginning fascination there. And it wasn't until I think much later, maybe before going into college mm-hmm. even, that I started I think in high school I grew up in the UK mostly. Mm-hmm. And you specialize quite quickly. After you're 15 or 16, you drop down from taking like 12 or 13 subjects to only taking 3.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't take any science. I was studying economics, philosophy, and Mandarin.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't until the year before starting college, I took a year off and was working on a fishing boat in Papua New Guinea, and mm-hmm. the captain of this fishing boat asked me at one point, he's like, well, you're going off to college after this. What are you thinking of doing with that? Mm-hmm. And back then I was like, oh, well, you know, maybe I'm thinking of studying psychology or maybe anthropology. Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, don't do that. Above all, don't do anthropology. Those people are creeps. And I was like, oh. And I mean, the background there, right, is that Papua New Guinea has been historically was like very studied by anthropologists. Mm-hmm, a lot of mm-hmm. anthropologists got very famous studying in Papua New Guinea. And I think that original research over there was in some ways very extractive. And that was kind of behind his idea that, oh, you know, they come in, they spy on us, they write things down, and then they leave every time. And he was like, well, well, don't do that. And so he was like, instead, you know, he's like, you could study something like marine biology, study something useful.
Oh.
And that was the first time that I thought of science or marine biology as something that could actually be useful for people instead of just creating knowledge. And I think it makes sense. He's a fisherman. He works on boats. Like, obviously, learning about the marine environment and how to protect it, that's very useful to him and to coastal communities. But for me, that was both this realizing that, oh, you know, there are ways to do science or ways to create knowledge that are more or less extractive, and then also that straight up marine biology or science can be something useful to people and to communities. I think that was a little turning point for me.
I love that just a random conversation just changed your trajectory. So you were taking a year off between high school and college, and you decide when you're going to college, you know what? Marine biology.
Yeah, I think my name is also Marina, and I not because of my name, but I think the name points to I grew up around the ocean very often, and my mom, like I said, is from Indonesia. Mm-hmm. My dad is from an island in the Mediterranean called Corsica, and they named me Marina because they were like, look, we're on different sides. We are from different sides of the world, and what's the thing that we have in common? It's the ocean that connects those two places, and so water and this connection with the ocean has always been a very important part of my life, but I definitely never considered studying it or doing that as a job or as a life work.
So then when you made this sudden shift and you go in, was it like, did you have to get used to the scientific rigor, or did you just take to it naturally? Because it's, you know, you weren't studying it at all in high school.
Yes, this has been an important part of my science journey, I think, is understanding what is science, actually, and what counts and what doesn't count as science. Mm-hmm. And it's true that the way science is taught in school can feel very narrow. It's that, you know, you learn these facts that have already been discovered, and there are these very set and use the word rigor. Like, there's this idea that there's a standard and, like, certain ways of doing things that have to be followed in order for what you're doing to count as science.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of my undergrad and coming into the PhD was working with people who are maybe slightly less conventional scientists, along with conventional scientists. For example, I spend a lot of time with Uncle Mac Poi Poi, who's an elder fisher and marine steward at Levaya from the island of Molokai, and this Levaya network, this fishing network that he put together called Nakai Iwalu, who are from a lot of the main Hawaiian islands. And they are also doing science, but they're not affiliated with a university, and they're learning about the culturally important, like, food fish from their area.
Mm-hmm.
They're collecting data and they're analyzing it, but it's outside of this, outside of the structure of academia. And I think that helped to working with them has been so inspirational, and having that alongside my advisors at Stanford has helped me better understand, like, oh, well, you know, to the extent that science is about observing the world, having ideas about how things work, and then testing those ideas or checking to see whether your idea was right or whether that accurately describes or can help predict what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Science is everywhere. And a lot of people who we don't in society call, like, scientists with a capital S are actually scientists, and they're doing amazing science.
Okay, so you're in college. You start studying marine biology. What's the first thing that you learned in college that blew your mind? She's thinking. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco.
I was always kind of almost going back to the banana slugs and all these cool animals that create, there are a lot of cool animals that create toxins and different chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned in college that, well, I'd heard about this, I think maybe a lot of, well, some people have heard that there are these stories of dolphins that kind of get high together in the water by playing with pufferfish.
I've heard that
and
too.
Yeah, have you heard this?
Yeah.
So, hearing, I'd heard that story and been like, oh, wow, that's, you know, that by itself is fascinating and kind of cool. But in college, I learned actually that what the pufferfish contains, that toxin, is called tetrodotoxin.
Uh-huh.
And not only does the, we know what that toxin is. That's cool. The pufferfish actually doesn't produce it by itself. It works together. It symbioses with this bacteria in its gut, and it's actually the bacteria that produces the tetrodotoxin, to which the pufferfish then uses for defense, and I guess in this case to dolphins co-opt that for their own play.
It cracks me up that there's so many animals besides humans that have figured out how to get high, like elephants. You know, they figured out which patches, you know, they can tromp through to get, you know, boozed up, and now you're telling me dolphins are licking puffer fish. It's a crazy world out there.
Yeah, and so fascinating. I feel like it's such a good reminder that, oh, obviously we're not the only things with the only mm-hmm. animals with minds and who have other experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay, so you are doing marine biology, and which direction grabs your attention and takes you to where you are now? And our listeners don't know where you are now, so tell them a little bit about what you do as well.
Mm. So I was always very interested in ecology, which is the subset of biology that's about like how things kind of hang together, how different, it could be animals, but it could be anything of any scale, kind of like how different organisms interact with each other,
mm-hmm.
and the links between those things. And also, like I said, had this interest in, well, really it was an interest in the mind. And so bringing those two things together, there's a field called chemical ecology, which is looking at how toxins, or I guess like drugs, cycle through environments and move from different, like, you know, substrates to animals.
So I don't understand. So you're talking about medicines that humans take that go into the environment, or what do you mean by it?
So the field of chemical ecology is very broad. It's like any chemicals and how those chemicals cycle through the environment and to and from different animals.
Okay.
Specifically, what I'm interested in, or in what I'm studying for my PhD, is a subset of those chemicals, which are, you could call them hallucinogens, or they that cause hallucinations.
Okay. Which chemicals cause hallucinations that you're studying?
There are all sorts, like, you know, famously psychedelics, I guess, or they can cause hallucinations, among mm-hmm. other things. I've done some work on 5-MeO-DMT, which is one of these compounds that comes from the Sonoran Desert toad. That it's also considered
for toad licking. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Don't lick them though.
Okay.
That's one. And I think what really interests me and what I'm hoping to learn more about is some of these lesser understood or maybe undiscovered hallucinogens that come from other natural sources like fish or lichen.
So you are studying how those toxins affect the ecology?
Yeah, so great question. Two parts. One is, okay, where do those molecules come from in the environment? Like, you know, is it something, say a fish, for example, is known to be toxic? Where does that toxin come from? Is it something that the fish is eating? Is the fish producing it itself? Is it working with the bacteria? Like mm-hmm. in the case of the pufferfish, that's one part of the question. And then the other part for me, which is, I guess, outside of chemical ecology, but is once we know what those compounds are, how do they impact the brain in a way that they're able to produce hallucinations or all these different, I guess, altered mind states?
And are you talking about hallucination? You're talking about hallucinations in people, because there's no way you can tell
if
fish are hallucinating, if they're just going, whoa, check that out. You have no way of knowing.
Totally.
So you talk about the hallucinations, the known hallucination I guess psychotropic or whatever. How do you determine, because you said, are there ones that we don't know about yet? So are there ones that have been discovered recently, like, you know, I don't know, you look at tilapia and you suddenly start seeing God, or, you know.
One that I think is absolutely amazing and was inspiration for work that I'm continuing into the PhD was is that there are certain fish in different parts of the world that mm-hmm. are known to contain some sort of toxin that that produces hallucinations.
Okay.
And the way we know about these fish in most or maybe all cases is based on traditional or like indigenous knowledge from the different areas where this is happening. Mm-hmm. And so the first time I heard about this or learned about this was in Hawaii. Like I said, I work with it's not originally about the fish, but kind of the moral of the story ends mm-hmm. up being about this fish, or
okay.
like saying that this fish is toxic in certain areas and certain times of year. There's mm-hmm. this like very detailed knowledge that comes out of what is otherwise an oral history that's very linked with, you know, different chiefs and
right. What was the fish?
The fish is the goatfish.
In
Hawaiian they're called veke.
Okay, and what so this oral tradition tells you that this fish is toxic. But how do they tell you this story? I mean, what's the story of this fish?
Okay, yeah, I wasn't sure whether I should go into it.
I
or not.
Want,
so, okay.
Yeah.
So this, so as far, and this is, you know, me reporting secondhand from, and different sources will state slightly different dates or whatnot, mm-hmm. but from a version of the oral history that I think is told by Mary Kavena Pukui, which is dated roughly back to the 1400s.
Okay. Goes way back.
There was a very famous chief on Maui called Kananaleo,
mm-hmm.
and his son was known to be super mischievous and was like always getting up to trouble. And one day he cut off, I think, all of the tops of the coconut trees from this like very special area. And mm-hmm. with that, the chief got super angry and was mm-hmm. like, that's it. You were in so much trouble. So he banished his son to the island of Lanai, which is just off of Maui,
okay.
But which is a you know, very scary thing to do because that was known to be the home of the chief of ghosts called Pahulu and his kind of like ghost warriors who
okay.
lived with him. And so the chief said to his son, well, you know, I'm banishing you to this island. If you can survive for a week, then I'll come back and get you. But if the ghosts get you, then, you know, that's it. This is your punishment. And so the story is all about the different ways that his son, Ka'ululau, mm-hmm. Goes about trying to survive and like trapping and killing these different ghosts. And on the last day, right before he could get rescued or not, it's like only him versus the chief of ghosts, Pahulu.
Okay.
And he manages to trick. He hides. He hides in a palm tree, and Pahulu sees his reflection. Oh yeah, on a full moon, and Pahulu sees his reflection in the water,
mm-hmm.
And thinks it's him. So he dives. The chief of ghosts dives into the water, and then Ka'ululau manages to cover him with a net, like throws a net on top of him and drowns him. And it's said that when he drowns, then the veke fish, these goatfish, which forage along the bottom, ate the chief of ghosts, and that's why when you eat this the heads of these fish now, you will have hallucinations and nightmares because that's the kind of the energy that's still in there.
That is a great story. Now I want a book of Hawaiian stories.
Absolutely. And I mean, they're like, they are oral histories in the Kananaleo and mm-hmm. Ka'ululau are mm-hmm. real people. Mm-hmm. And this is all like very, tied in with this incredible knowledge and tradition. And so, yeah, I love being able to tell that because I was so inspired by this and like, yeah, always want to make make known that that's like very much the origin of a lot of this like research and
that's
work.
That's very, very cool. So in your research, what is like a day in your research life look like?
My research life is maybe split into three main parts. And so I guess each day will be quite different, but there's maybe different seasons of the research. The exciting, like, oh, biologists, this is maybe what most people think of when they think of certain types of biology is mm-hmm. the field work portion.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I'll be going out working with fishers, fishing fish, looking at fish, observing fish.
So
eating.
You're out in the field?
I'm out in the, yeah,
exactly, okay.
out in the ocean. That's one portion. Usually that will transition into a wet lab portion. So I'll be in suddenly indoors in a lab doing either like molecular biology work or chemical work. And so that's a lot of pipetting and moving different colored liquids from tubes, one tube to another, and then into different machines, and then analyzing that data. So then there's this computer portion as well.
So you're out, when you're out in the ocean, what fish are you looking for? Or what are you looking for that you're like, this is probably toxic, let's get it?
So based on, yeah, in the cases of, for example, with this, the goatfish, we know from this oral history that there's a particular species in a particular areas in certain times of year. And so that's quite targeted. There are also, and in every case, it's helpful to have a, to try and find some sort of a comparison, like a known non-toxic fish at the same time. And then if we have this hypothesis that, oh, you know, maybe these fish are getting their toxins from their diet, then it's also important to take samples of what they're eating. So that could be their gut contents, for example, or like, oh, if they're known to forage in this certain area, then maybe you would also take samples from, you know, the substrate where they're eating.
So you talk about how puffer fish, they're not producing it per se. There's like an interaction between the bacteria that live on it, right? So is that true? I guess, are there fish that just produce toxins versus this symbiotic relationship?
Yes, is my understanding. There are a lot of different fish produce a lot of different types of toxins. Lionfish, for example, produce, I'm pretty sure that they produce their own toxins.
They're kind of sting if they hit you, right?
They also have, I think their fins might also be like pointed for like a barb sort of, but I think there's also venom in there. And same with stingrays, even though those are maybe sort of elasmobranchs.
So you talk about these toxins that produce hallucinogens. Is there a point where if you have too much of that fish, it will kill you? Or will it just, you know, will you just be tripping balls?
There haven't been. I've never seen any reports of, there have never been any reports of death from this. At the same time, I do want to stress that there's, I say hallucinogens instead of psychedelics because I think psychedelics have this connotation of there being something positive. And, you know, when people talk about tripping, it's like usually a positive thing or often portrayed as a positive thing. Mm-hmm. In these cases, all the reports are that this is very negative. It's like nightmares and horrifying hallucinations. So it's not not something that people look for.
Right. How quickly do these, like, let's say you inadvertently eat something, you're out fishing, you don't know anything, you catch one of these fish, you eat it, is there a delayed reaction? Because you talked about dreams, or are you suddenly just thrown into this hallucinogenic nightmare?
I think there's usually a few hours from what people, from like reports and medical reports or whatnot, there's like a few hour lag.
Okay. And then by studying this, what knowledge do you hope to gain?
So hallucinations are very fascinating, I think, in an abstract sort of way that like, wow, how do these things come about? And there are a lot of, when you look at, that's a subjective experience, but in terms of how that links to something happening in the brain, there are a lot of different mechanisms for it. And I think seeing as these things come from a marine source or for any of the animals that would be interesting to study, there's always this chance that like, oh, are there mechanisms that we haven't yet discovered or that we don't yet understand that create hallucinations? And if we do that, can that help us to design better drugs, for example, or improve the drugs that we already have to avoid negative side effects, for example?
So is there a possibility that in a pharmaceutical setting, maybe they discover that, well, if we give them this much, it actually will help with certain types of mental illness. If we give them this much, it would be too much. Is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking just sort of abstractly?
I think, yeah, maybe less So there is always a chance, like, exactly, of, and this is how a lot of drugs have been discovered, is like coming from natural mm-hmm. sources. Mm-hmm. At the same time, for this particular, in this particular case, my sense is that it's more of a, it contributes more to our understanding of mechanisms and less as a direct, directly like, oh, this is a cool new drug that would be immediately useful.
Now, you talked about this oral tradition from Hawaii, and both of your parents are sort of from island cultures. So do they have any types of oral history stories that tie in with what you do? Like what, especially since now they know, oh, my daughter is a marine biologist. And
yeah, there are also, in Corsica, there's also a fish thought to, or in the Mediterranean, a fish thought to cause hallucinations and nightmares in a way that sounds very similar to the Hawaiian fish. And that's originally, when I was hearing about all of this, it's kind of what piqued my interest, because I was like, oh, we have this back home also. Mm-hmm. Like, what's going on there?
Do you know what fish it is? Did your dad tell you about it? Or is it just something you heard about?
It's something I heard about. My dad actually, it's funny, Corsica is a very mountainous region, and my family are from the, even though it's an island, so we're surrounded by water. Water is important, of course, mm-hmm. but my family come from the mountains, and traditionally a lot of Corsicans do live in the mountains, because we were always, through history, have always been invaded from the coast. And so kind of the safe places were up there.
That tracks. How about your mom? Like, once your mom knew that you heard these traditions, did your mom start sharing any types of stories, or did she just go, what do you want to know that old stuff for?
I think similarly, I think not, the stories didn't come like flowing out. And same with my grandparents. I think like they've always been sort of like, oh, wow, she's doing her thing.
They're just supportive in general.
And yeah, exactly.
Whatever you want to do. You want to fly kites. You want to do marine biology, become president. Whatever makes you happy, dear. Okay. So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We're speaking with Maria Lucioni. We're talking about marine biology and toxins that that are hallucinogenic. What other stuff can you tell me about this hallucinogenic toxin thing that you're studying? Like, what kinds of things, when you're telling it to kids, what kind of things fascinate them about it? And this is radio, so you can think out loud.
I will. Okay, when you were first starting to say that, I think I had a less kid-friendly...
Oh, that's fine.
Okay. I feel like there are also lots of fun kid-friendly facts as well. I wanted to stress that I think a lot of, so the toxin part of my work is so exciting and so important, but a huge side of the whole thing for me has been that in order to continue doing this very exciting, more abstract kind of like basic science work, it's also felt super important, I've realized, or I've been like taught, that it's super important to also pay attention to like, oh, well, where is this fish actually from? Like, where is that knowledge coming from? Who are the communities and the places that this is coming from? And how do I engage well and be a good collaborator with the people from those areas, and also the people from the areas and the place itself? Like, how does, I think it feels very important to me that my research, even though it has this abstract and basic side, also has this kind of more applied and kind of like
practical
and kind of more like, okay, so you do your fun and exciting thing, and then also how do you take responsibility for the impact that you're having, or for like, if you're gaining something, how is the place that you're taking that thing from also gaining something out of your work? So that's brought a big part of my work into the more like steward, I guess you could call it stewardship, or kind of like marine, or in some cases conservation, but more kind of like management, thinking about fish as food and thinking about, you know, the environment that this fish is from, and like, how do we learn more about it in a way that's like useful for that place and those people. And one super cool thing that's started in Hawaii is this concept of community-based subsistence fishing areas. And so that's Again, the person who I, Uncle Mac Poi Poi, who I work with, kind of spearheaded this in Hawaii. And it's this system where different community groups can apply for this designation as a community-based subsistence fishing area. And okay. It means that together as a community, they can work together with the state to set the rules for that particular place to do with, you know, fishing and harvesting and how they want people entering that area to take care of the place. And that, I guess, while I'm doing my work on the toxins of these fish, I'm also helping with work to do with the monitoring of different fish species that can help inform, you know, like what rules or what kind of like management options that these community-based subsistence fishing areas have. And so I'm like a very small piece of that team, but it feels like a very important part, or it is a very important part, or kind of like a flip side to the toxin work.
So in doing that, in, you know, sort of giving back and that stewardship, what kinds of challenges have you encountered in trying to make it a reality?
Definitely it sometimes feels like walking in two worlds, where in Hawaii, with the group who I work with, Nakae Valu, they fully understand this two sides of the coin. They're like, oh, you know, there's the academic side of research, and then there's, you know, research that can be academic, but that's also very kind of like community engaged and like based on where the research questions are set by the group who I'm working with, and not necessarily by this like, oh, what would be, you know, like interesting to publish necessarily. They understand fully that those two things go together, and that they balance each other, and that when you're creating knowledge, it's important to think about how you're going to steward, like take care of that knowledge that you're creating, and take care of the places that you're working with. On the other side, in more, I guess, academic circles or at Stanford where I work, that's not always a common understanding. So that's definitely, it's a challenge sometimes where I feel like I need to justify or even just like explain it all, how those two things go together. I think like some people will think that seems unfocused on my end, or they'll think it's a waste of time even. Oh. So that's sometimes a challenge, but not to say I have the most, you know, I have the most supportive advisor, Larry Crowder. There's definitely people who and members of my committee, like Rodolfo Dirzo, Tad Fukami, they've been super supportive, but that's just not always common understanding.
Understood. Now, I want to know if your Uncle Poi Poi knows what a huge impact he had in the trajectory of your career.
I hope absolutely.
Like, have you talked to him? It's like, because of what you said, this is what I'm doing.
Yes. I mean, we work together.
Oh, okay.
So I definitely, we're on calls at least every month, sometimes more than that. We're on a big group call this evening at 7.
Oh, okay.
So we're definitely, and you know, we gather in person with the group Nakae Valu. We gather in person twice a year, and are definitely continuing research on these different you know, there's another species called moi, and right now we're focusing on mullet, on different types of Hawaiian mullet together.
Okay. And I can't remember if I asked you this already, so I'll pose it again. In the course of your research, what's something that you've learned that blew your mind, that, you know, that you had no idea about?
From my own research?
Or anybody's research, but just something in the course of moving forward through your career, what's something that you went, oh my God, I had no, like there was a scientist who could turn a brain into glass, and that I was like, wow. So what's something that just, you know, touched your mind?
There's so much, actually, I could have like a whole list. There is so many things, right? One, really, seeing as we're on this subject, thinking about Hawaii and learnings there, the folks, and in lots of parts of the world this happens also, fishing often happens by the lunar calendar. Mm. So at different phases of the moon, and there are different amounts of like specificity with this, where at different phases of the moon, people will think, will say, like, you know, this is a better phase for fishing, this is a worse phase. But in Hawaii, there's even in certain locations, there's even more fine-grained knowledge than that, where they will know that, you know, for this species, in this place, at this time of the moon, this is a good time to go. So this...
And that just goes, that's knowledge that's just carried down from generation to generation. Well, and so of that's, observation.
It's both, it's passed down, but it's also something, I think... When people talk about indigenous knowledge or traditionally ecological knowledge, that sounds like knowledge is a static thing. But actually what comes along with that is the process for how did that get figured out in the first place? And that's science. So
yeah, I often wonder, like, you know, how did people figure out how to eat an artichoke? You know, they had to be starving and trying, you know, but I wonder about those types of things. Like, how do we get to where they know this sort of intricate way of interacting with this thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's fun is also to see it happening in real time, because with, you know, climate change or other, you know, changes to pollution or human activity, a lot of these natural patterns change, right? And in the case of, you know, fish, and with this group who I work with, you see that happening in real time, and you can see the process for relearning the patterns also. Well, yeah, which is, you know, the science happening to, like, reestablish, like, oh, okay, what's the new, what are the new norms? What is the, okay, this fish isn't showing up at this moon, in this, for example, for in this lunar cycle in the way that we were expecting it to. Like, what's the new time? What's the new place where this is happening? So that's a small example. I'm thinking of now that we're talking about fish moving, earlier this year in Nature, there was this paper about herring in Norway, which they're the small food fish, right? Okay, yeah. They started, the researchers, people started noticing that the herring weren't showing up in the place that they'd like stopped doing their migration. And so they weren't showing up in the bays that they would usually show up, which was a big problem for fishers, because fishers would usually wait in those bays to catch the herring. And what they found out was that, or what they very convincingly showed, is that because of a certain type of overfishing of the larger and older herring, it meant that those herring schools weren't able, the younger herring weren't able to learn from the older herring where to migrate anymore. And so they'd forgotten or like lost this migration knowledge. And so instead they were migrating much less, basically. Like, the younger fish were just guessing and going to this random other bay instead.
That's amazing. I mean, you never think about, I mean, you think about lost knowledge in human populations, but you never think about it in animal populations. That's incredible. You just blew my mind. I love that. I want to talk to you so much longer, but I do have an interview later on. So I want to ask about, like, when you talk to kids and they ask you what you do, what do you tell them?
I say that I study toxic animals that can cause hallucinations and nightmares, and I want to learn about where those toxins come from and how they impact the brain and mind, but doing that in a way that is where I'm being a good partner to the people and to the places that I work in.
And silly question, which is, do you still keep slugs as pets and feed them strawberries?
I don't, but I really look forward to having kids so that we can do the same thing together.
So tell our listening audience where you do your research and who your, like, advisors are.
So I'm a PhD candidate right now at Stanford. My main advisor is Larry Crowder, the incredible Larry Crowder. And my incredible committee are Rodolfo Dirzo, Tad Fukami, Justin Dubois, and Tanya Lerman.
Excellent. And one last thing is, how did you get involved with Wonderfest?
Good question. I got an email where I was invited or nominated, and was so excited to accept, but I honestly don't know where the email came from. So that was its own mystery.
Ghost fish. And, well, Marina, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if people want to find out more about your research, where can they go online?
I have a project website, which is marinaluccioni.com. And if not, I think for learning about these different fish and these different groups, I would say, yeah, learning about community-based subsistence fishing areas in Hawaii. If you just type that into Google, there's a lot to learn about there as
Excellent.
Well.
Well, Maria Lucioni, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Okay, people of Earth, you've learned a lot about toxicity and hallucinogens, and per Marina's instructions, do not lick anything unless you know that it's going to be delicious. I'm coming up, we'll be talking about the Velveteen Rabbit, but inspired by Marina, let's listen to Toxic.
Baby, can't you see I'm calling? A guy like you should wear a warning. It's dangerous, I'm falling. There's no escape, I can't wait. I need a hit, baby. It's getting late to give you up. I took a sip from my devil's cup. Can Don't you know that you're toxic?
Postmodern Jukebox and Toxic. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. I promised you some Velveteen Rabbit, and I've got some people here to talk about it. I'd like to welcome from ODC, Mia Chang and KT Nelson. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Hi.
So for our listening audience, what does ODC stand for and how long has it been around?
ODC stands for Oberlin Dance Collective. And we have been around in San Francisco for over 50 years.
Wow.
And we're now coming into our 39th year of the Velveteen Rabbit. So we have definitely been around in San Francisco.
Wow. So the Velveteen Rabbit is a classic that you guys do, you know, almost every year.
Yes, it's an annual tradition that has become a holiday family tradition in the ODC community. And we're so excited that the rabbit is now almost 40 years old.
Now, I never read The Velveteen Rabbit, and I'm assuming that other people are not familiar with the story. So give us a little synopsis of the story.
Okay, so don't be shy that you didn't hear it, because I didn't hear it until I was 28 years old when I decided to choreograph to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a story of a boy who is given a stuffed rabbit at Christmas, and he's like pretty indifferent to it. And then he finds that he really, really loves it. And it's through their ongoing relationship and losing the rabbit and then finding the rabbit and then getting sick. And the rabbit is supposed to be burnt with all the other books and toys because he's had scarlet fever. And the rabbit realizes, oh, it's going to be... going to pass. It's no longer going to be in this world. And it's through that great bit of loss that the rabbit becomes real. And I think what's wonderful about this story is Marjorie Williams is very witty. You know, she talks about getting shabby and old, and you don't mind being hurt and getting shabby and old because you learn about love and you get wise. And she's very fun in doing this. And but that's what happens to the rabbit. It gets really shabby and old and then becomes real.
Hmm. And I think a lot of children love that story, correct?
Yes. And the other thing is we have narration throughout the story. It's done by Jeff Hoyle. It's recorded. But it allows children are used to listening to being told a story. So it allows us to, in the choreography, to just play. You know, the boy can slide off the stage, he can have a pillow fight, and I don't have to mime the story because the story is told.
Understood.
And that is very useful for the young kids.
Very nice. Now, what roles do both of you play in this production?
Well, I originated the choreography in 1986 when my son was two.
Aww.
And only recently now, Mia has taken over remounting it and adding her own directorial touch to it. She did it fully this year for the first time.
Wow. And so are you both artistic directors?
KT will always be the creator and choreographer of Velveteen Rabbit, but it's been really great that she's brought me in to be her staging director. So I basically have been rehearsing the company and adding little refreshing moments, new additions in collaboration with KT. And I'm getting to bring my own love and history and experience into the staging of it. So it's definitely a collaboration between the two of us.
Very cool. Now, you mentioned that your son, you did it when your son was two. Does your son come to every performance, or is it just a beautiful childhood memory for your son?
Well, so that's the other thing. He was in it because there are 10 children from the ODC school that are in it. And one of the things I noticed when I took my son to any show is when a kid was on stage, when he was little, mm-hmm. he would sit up in a seat. That really engaged him. So there is a 10-student children's chorus inside this production.
Wow.
And he went many times when he was young. He is coming this year with his two children, so my grandchildren, who are 2 and 4.
That warms my heart. And I agree, because when I was a kid, if there was a movie, if the movie had kids in it, I was way more engaged than if it was just grown up. So excellent. That's pretty awesome. So when does it start?
So in 1986 is when I made the first rendition of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say, I didn't read the story. I heard the story read out loud with a piano player and Meryl Streep. And it was like a bedtime story recorded,
uh-huh.
which I think is, I've always heard it as a formative thing, not a literary thing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
So yes, yes.
I feel like it was already alive by experiencing it being read out loud with music. And then I slowly put together an evening-length version of it, which it means 60 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in two parts. And we like the kids when they laugh and enjoy themselves. We don't tell them to sit tidy.
Well, children, I've seen this thing that says the more children fidget when they're watching something, the more they're engaged in it. It's like their whole body feels the story.
Yes, and I do think it helps that we have narration.
Mm-hmm.
So they're listening to the story.
So when kids see the show, do you ever have kids who, because they've seen the show, then they want to be dancers or rabbits?
Well, I don't know about the rabbit part, but I think they do want to become dancers. And we invite them to dance at our school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I've done outreach, years ago I went to schools all the time and did outreach. And we did lots of stuff around, one, becoming real,
mm-hmm.
two, about language, like how to make fancy all the stuff. Marjorie Williams' language, we made sentences and movement around her language that's actually in the show. Mm-hmm. And so I got them dancing before they came.
Very cool, very cool. So for our listening audience who's now really fascinated and wants to go to the show, when and where? And where do they get tickets?
We have shows running from now through December 7th. Our weekday and Saturday performances are at 11 a.m., and our Sunday performances are at 2 p.m., and you can come see us at the Blue Shield of California Theater at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. And you can find more information and discounted tickets at odc.dance.
And then if people have aspiring dancers who'd like to get involved with the company, is there a process that is involved?
Yes, you can find more information about getting started as a dancer on odc.dance, our website, where there are hundreds of classes in every style for every level and every age.
And we have a very robust youth and teen program. It's really quite lovely. Lots of options of kinds of classes you can take and lots of kinds of teachers.
Okay. Well, then for our listening audience, repeat once again where, what time, and your website.
You can come and see Velveteen Rabbit at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Our shows run from now through December 7th, and you can find more information at odc.dance.
Excellent. Well, Mia Chong and KT Nelson, I want to thank you both for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity. It's going to be a lovely show. So that's something you're going to want to go check out. It's time for me to check out and turn the microphone over to Mr. Ford, who'll be pleasuring your ear hole. So I I'm not going to keep you waiting. I'm going to leave you with a little bit of Rosin Coven. This is The Zookeeper's Awakening. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
Do as I say, I'm in charge here.
Jump, I said jump.
Plié, arabesque. Do you hear?